from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the new strain of coronavirus has now sickened more than 800 people, mostly in China, and the death toll has risen to 26. The Chinese government has put Wuhan and other affected regions essentially on lockdown, while the first two U.S. cases were confirmed just this week. Federal officials, however, say the threat to the nation is low. So how worried should we be here about the coronavirus? We get the latest. Then we look at the life and impact of public broadcasting's Jim Lehrer, who died yesterday. That's all next on Forum. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A second U.S. case of the new coronavirus has been confirmed this morning by federal health officials, this time in Illinois. Earlier this week, a man in Washington state who visited Wuhan was the first person diagnosed in the U.S. The virus has sickened 830 people, mainly in China, and killed at least 26. We take your questions about this new strain of coronavirus in this opening 40 minutes of Forum and assess the likelihood of this illness becoming a global health emergency. Joining me is Leslie McClurg, and she is a science reporter for KQED. And Leslie, I know you've been covering it this week, and here in the U.S., we're hearing about more than 60 potential cases of the new coronavirus that are under investigation in more than 20 states. So what can you tell us about the people who were actually diagnosed in Illinois and Washington state?
They're both, fortunately, in stable condition. They're both being monitored very, very closely in isolation. They're being extremely careful to see if the virus is still continuing or, whether their conditions are changing, et cetera. But right now, they're just showing symptoms, but not in any kind of critical condition. It's a woman in her 60s in Chicago who was recently diagnosed. She had traveled to Wuhan in late December and returned on January 13th and started noticing that she was feeling sick. Neither of these people were caught during airport screenings because those airport screenings started happening after both of these people had returned from China, and both had visited Wuhan, the city where this is taking place, the outbreak.
Yes, so there are travel restrictions that have been imposed on Wuhan. I mean, the city is essentially on lockdown, and it's been extended to dozens of other cities. And this is, of course, during Lunar New Year, which is the busiest travel season, or one of the busiest, in China and in Asia. So what can you tell us about the situation in China and how the government, the medical system, is coping?
Yeah, I would say that what's so interesting about what's happening right now is how fast things are changing. When I talked to people who had been returning from Wuhan on Tuesday, I happened to catch the last flight, direct flight into San Francisco, and people weren't really that worried. Their sense of the situation was, the media is sort of, overblowing the situation. And now you're hearing on Twitter and from people, reporters on the ground who are talking to people right now, that it is basically a pretty frantic situation. And people feel, scared. They're staying home. They're getting their meals delivered. Shanghai Disneyland is closed. Right now is one of the times of the year where Chinese are going. They've taken their maybe one vacation to go visit family or to cross the country. And those travel arrangements are, basically not happening. And people are, there's a level of fear and frustration in the government. Hospitals are being overrun. They're running out of supplies. There's an effort right now to build a new hospital outside of Wuhan with 100 beds, like kind of an emergency hospital situation to care for people. So I would say in the matter of hours, things are changing and panic is rising.
And the coronavirus has spread not just to several provinces in China, to the U.S., but also to Japan, Thailand, Singapore, Vietnam.
South Korea.
Yes, South Korea. And so I'm going to bring Chris Kreuter-Johnson into the conversation. She's a professor of epidemiology and ecosystem health at UC Davis. She's also associate director of the One Health Institute at the School of Veterinary Medicine at Davis. Welcome to Forum, Chris Kreuter-Johnson.
Thank you for having me.
So we're talking about the spread of this, but it all is believed to have originated from an animal market in Wuhan. What can you tell us about what they're learning about the animal that it may have come from or animals?
Sure. Yeah, at this time, we still know very little about this new virus, including how it was initially transmitted to humans. They do know that the initial cluster of cases in Wuhan were connected to a market that sold seafood as well as live poultry and wild animals for meat. The first cases, in fact, were among vendors and consumers at that market. That market was quickly closed and disinfected January 1st as reports were coming out about this new outbreak.
And so did the fact that it was quickly closed and disinfected, has that actually made it harder to isolate the source?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely makes surveillance efforts not possible at this point. So the actual source of the virus is not known. We do know a lot based on the genetic identity of the virus. It's highly related to coronaviruses that have been circulating in bats and have been found in bats in China. So we suspect that bats are the original reservoir, but it's quite likely that another animal became infected with the virus from bats and then went on to transmit the virus to people in the markets. And more than likely, there were probably a couple spillover events that went from bats into an animal being sold in the market, and then a spillover event that happened from animals in the market to people.
And how is it transmitted from animals to people?
Well, we know that the live animal market situation is particularly risky. So any close contact with animals, any direct contact with animals can result in what we call zoonotic disease transmission of a virus from animals to people. And viruses can be shed through respiratory tract secretions and urine and feces and so on and so forth. And it can also be directly transmitted through consumption of animals, and the animals were being sold for meat at this market.
Is there any reason that these viruses, I mean, we remember SARS from several years ago, that viruses like this are emerging from China?
Yeah, well, we know that the source most likely of this virus is bats, and there's a huge diversity of bat species in China and a lot of people to just sort of increase or improve that probability game that spillover will occur. But we also know that live animal markets are particularly risky. When animals are confined in very, very small spaces, and especially when you bring in a lot of different species that would not normally be in contact with each other in nature, and you bring those species together, and viruses start to jump hosts. And when they start to jump hosts, we know that they're adapting an ability to move between species that then ultimately puts humans at risk. And when you also have a market that sells live domesticated species where people are in a lot of contact with domesticated species, we're just increasing the probability that these viruses will spill over.
Right, which also means that this, of course, will not be an incident that's isolated to China. I mean, it's an ongoing problem. Your organization works in dozens of countries to try to understand how diseases get passed from animals to humans. So is this a frontier of illness that there's still a lot of questions around?
I think this is a frontier where we need a lot of improved surveillance. So yeah, the USAID and International Development Agency worked with us on their Emerging Pandemic Threats Program, and we did partner to strengthen zoonotic disease detection with 30 different countries. And we really tried to implement one health surveillance where we would look at both animals and people that are engaged in what we call these high-risk interfaces or situations where there's much more likely to be animal-to-human transmission. And I think we really need improved surveillance on both fronts, definitely on the wildlife side. We know that most emerging infectious diseases are going to come from wildlife. That has been what's been happening over the last several decades. And we also need improved surveillance in people, especially people that are on these front lines, such as these vendors and people that are consuming in the market, as well as people who continue to hunt and consume wildlife all over the world.
Again, Christine Quater Johnson is professor of epidemiology and ecosystem health at the School of Veterinary Medicine at UC Davis. We also have Leslie McClurg with us, science reporter for KQED, who has been covering the coronavirus for us here. And I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. What are your questions for our guests? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on Facebook, on Twitter. You can tweet us at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. This new strain of coronavirus has killed dozens in China and spread to as far as the U.S. from Wuhan, where the illness is believed to have originated and originated with animals. So, Leslie McClurg, you were at SFO earlier this week and talking with passengers, as you mentioned. And what is the effectiveness of airport screenings for an illness that may not show symptoms initially as people are coming in? And, you know, it's kind of after the fact at this point. The two cases that we did have in the U.S. Are of people who were not who came through the airports before the screening process took place. But would they have been caught if they had come in? You know, it's an open question.
Yeah, I think, you know, the CDC is obviously putting a lot of resources on the ground to do this and would argue that this is an important precautionary measure to try to stop cases. But as you know, the CDC representative that I talked to did say, you know, no measure is going to be foolproof for sure. They may or may not. There are definitely some critical voices against, but critical of that. Airport screening is actually going to do much. For example, the World Health Organization does not recommend that countries around the world do airport screening because it hasn't been shown to really justify the amount of resources that are necessary to do it. And for example, both of these cases, maybe if the airport screening was taking place, they would have been caught, but they might not have been if they might not have been showing symptoms yet. So at the airport, I think it's important to know they're taking your temperature and they're asking you to fill out a health questionnaire. Are you coughing? Do you have fever? Are you having trouble breathing? So if you're feeling fine still, but you might be infected, but you're just not showing symptoms, you could, you know, potentially get through that screening and infect people here in another place. So I would say, you know, it depends on who you ask, but there's definitely some criticism that we're putting too much effort into it.
We're joined now by Charles Chu. He's a professor of medicine at UCSF. He specializes in infectious diseases. Thanks for joining us on Forum.
Thank you.
So let's just get down to basics here. What is a coronavirus? Because my understanding is it's the same virus as the common cold.
It is. So coronaviruses are a family. It's a family of viruses, and they do belong to a group of viruses that cause the common cold. Other viruses in this group include rhinoviruses and adenoviruses. And coronaviruses are simply a family of respiratory viruses that cause respiratory infections. What makes this a little different are that certain coronaviruses have recently crossed over or jumped over from animals to humans, what we call zoonotic transmission. So some examples would be in 2002, we had SARS coronavirus, which was a species jump, as well as MERS coronavirus in, I believe, around 2011, which came from camels. And so this is another coronavirus. It appears to cause respiratory disease along with other coronaviruses, but we just don't know where it came from.
And how dangerous is this virus? I mean, the number of cases and deaths grow daily. Is this because it's spreading so rapidly or because existing cases are finally being diagnosed and the numbers updated? Charles Chu.
Yeah, we actually do not know at this point exactly how dangerous or deadly the virus may be. I think part of the reason is that it's still very, very early in the course of the outbreak, and there have been hundreds of cases, yes, and several fatalities. Based on the early data, it does suggest that this does not appear to be as deadly as, for instance, SARS coronavirus or even MERS coronavirus. I believe there, as of today, there are probably 20 21 fatalities in more than 600 cases. So that's fatalities meaning patients who develop the disease and die from it. So it does not appear to be as dangerous as prior coronaviruses, but it's still very early days.
And actually, the numbers that I was seeing were more than 826 deaths at this point.
Updates.
Yes.
Okay,
again, it just continues to grow. So then we were talking with Leslie McClurg about how they're doing screenings at the airport. But what symptoms should people be on the lookout for, especially if they've traveled to China or other regions in Asia that are reporting cases?
Yes. So coronavirus infections cause a respiratory illness, and it's just as in any viral flu-like illness, patients or individuals who are infected can demonstrate fever, cough, nasal congestion. In a subset of patients, in a small proportion of patients, they may then develop more severe disease, chest pain, chest tightness, and shortness of breath that can develop into a life-threatening pneumonia. But it presents initially as any other common cold or viral like flu-like illness.
Leslie McClurg, you wanted to jump in.
I'll just jump in the sense that initially it looked like it was mostly older people with pre-existing conditions who were dying from this virus. And just recently they announced that a man 36 years old in Shanghai has died. So it does look like it might be affecting. And he was perfectly healthy. He died of cardiac arrest a couple hours before the diagnosis.
So is that increasing the concern, Dr. Chu, in terms of how this virus infects people and can affect people who did not have pre-existing conditions, who were apparently young and healthy?
I think it is concerning, but that was actually the case with, some other viruses that we've seen. For instance, the 2009 H1N1 pandemic influenza virus, where it appeared to disproportionately cause perhaps severe disease in younger people. I do want to stress, though, that really is early days, and we can't make conclusions about how deadly this virus is. I think probably what's more concerning to me is the fact that this virus clearly is able to be transmitted from person to person, for human to human transmission.
Mean it can mutate essentially or?
Yeah, this virus, regardless of whether or not the virus can mutate, the greater concern is that the capacity for human-to-human transmission, what that means is if it transmits very efficiently, it would be very difficult to stop this outbreak. It's very difficult to curb the spread of the outbreak. What I'm worried about is that this may be an outbreak that would be very difficult or even impossible to stop. And it certainly has that potential if it really transmits efficiently from person to person. So even if you have, say, a virus that's not that deadly, or perhaps only causes severe disease in a small fraction of patients, if you have millions of people infected, it still results in a large number of deaths from the virus.
So then do you agree with the World Health Organization's assessment at this point that this is not a global emergency, that they have not been willing to declare it so at this point?
I believe that the World Health Organization is being cautious at this point. We've seen evidence of transmissibility from person to person. I believe what the World Health Organization is looking for, though, is evidence of sustained transmission, what we describe as ongoing transmission past its initial introduction into a country. If there's evidence of sustained transmission, I do believe the World Health Organization will be likely to declare this an emergency.
Well, Emily asks,
not yet.
Yes. Is there any reason to avoid traveling to Chicago? We have plans to travel there next week. That's where the latest case has been confirmed in the U.S. Should this person avoid that, Dr. Chu?
I don't think there's any particular reason to avoid travel to Chicago. It's probably simply by chance that we're doing a screening at major airports and really across the United States. The CDC is conducting surveillance for the virus. I suspect that we will likely have additional cases, but they'll tend to pop up where surveillance is being done. And I know that we previously had the discussion about whether or not airport-based surveillance is going to be effective. I do agree with the other speaker in that I believe that it may be perhaps too little, too late, and perhaps not effective. But it definitely is an attempt to prevent transmission into this country.
What do you think is the likelihood that this illness will come to California, to the Bay Area, if it hasn't already? We do have, San Francisco International Airport was one of the first airports to have screenings put in place because of direct flights from Wuhan And so there's a lot of questions, especially among our listeners, about the likelihood that it will be here in the Bay Area and what can be done for prevention.
I think it's likely that we may eventually see cases, simply because based on the data from China, based on the information that's coming from China, this does appear to be a relatively contagious virus. There have been several examples, for instance, of what we call hospital-acquired transmission, where infected patients in China transmitted to multiple healthcare workers. We've also seen some examples of sustained cycles of transmission in China, meaning that someone's infected but then infects somebody else and in turn affects somebody else. So I believe that it's only a matter of time before we'll start to see additional cases.
Well, Xavier asks, I was surprised that the coverage on the Seattle individual didn't include information on the airports he visited or even confirmation he used the Seattle airport. There also wasn't an acknowledgement that this information is being withheld. Is this normal? Is this advisable? It's interesting, Leslie McClurg, because I understand that one of the things that they were looking at was whether the Washington case, that the man had even traveled through SFO as on a connecting flight potentially. So do we have any more insight into where?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. I don't have more insight on exactly where he flew in. I think to address both that listener's concerns and the woman who is traveling to Chicago, those people who have come across and who are infected, the CDC is monitoring anyone that they have come in close contact with since they have arrived. And so they are trying to make sure anyone that that person, you know, had dinner with or talked to or whatever. And the man in Chicago, in Seattle, apparently had not been in contact with very many people. And both of them live alone, etc. So there was a fair amount of, you know, what should I say, surveillance around those people who have come across to make sure that they're not spreading it. So to relay their concerns.
Well, speaking also, Charles Chu, about information being withheld, there were concerns that the Chinese government is not being as transparent as they should be, maybe not sharing information as readily as they could be because of concerns about the previous, you know, SARS epidemic when the Beijing government withheld a lot of information initially about it. Do you think that this time around the government is sharing enough information about the cases?
I do think that things are different with regards to disclosure versus what happened in 2002 with the SARS outbreak. For instance, in 2002, there was a lot of information that was simply not available for several weeks. I do believe that the Chinese government has been pretty straightforward about providing information as they obtain reliable information. To give you an example, the genome sequence of the virus was released a mere weeks after the initial case, and actually an analysis of the genome sequences that have been done to date actually suggests that this was a very recent introduction, from animals to humans. And what that suggests to me is that the Chinese government did detect this virus relatively early, or very early in the course of the outbreak, very soon after a presumed species jump from an animal to a human. So we are getting information that's being updated on a daily basis. I do believe that there's a balance between providing information and making sure that that information is reliable and is supportable. So I really feel that certainly the Chinese government was much more forthright this time around versus in 2002.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Chu, professor of medicine at UCSF. He specializes in infectious disease. Also, Leslie McClurg, science reporter for KQED. And earlier, we were joined by Chris Kreuter-Johnson, professor of epidemiology and ecosystem health at UC Davis. We'll take more of your questions, comments after the break. The number to call if you have one, 866-733-6786, or you can post them on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A second case of coronavirus was confirmed today in the United States as China's efforts to control its outbreak has expanded significantly. CDC officials say while the outbreak is a very serious public health threat, the immediate risk to the U.S. public is low. There are more than 830 confirmed cases, and at least 26 people have died in China from this new coronavirus. And nearly 8,500 people are reported to be under observation, including some 60 in the United States. We're joined by Charles Chu, professor of medicine at UCSF, specializing in infectious disease, and Leslie McClurg, science reporter for KQED. And you are listeners at 866-733-6786 or by posting your comments on Twitter, Facebook, or on email. Forum at kqed.org. And Louise asks, does recent recovery from a coronavirus provide wider immunity to other coronaviruses? Dr. Chu?
That's a great question. I believe the answer is that we simply don't know right now. We don't know whether or not immunity from, say, infection from this coronavirus would confer immunity or protection against other coronaviruses. What I can say is that this is quite different. The closest relative genetically of this virus is actually SARS coronavirus. But the actual degree of homology or identity is only about 80%. So in other words, this virus only shares 80% of its DNA, RNA, actually in this case, RNA, in common with SARS. There is a related coronavirus to this virus. It's actually found in bats, which is 96% identical. But there was a coronavirus that was identified from a bat. But so far as we know, that bat coronavirus has never been in the human population. So it's very likely, but we can't say for sure, that infection with this coronavirus will not confer immunity, although it's really too early to make any definitive statements.
SARS ultimately took 800 lives, but how did it stop?
Yeah, SARS was an outbreak that sort of began in 2002 and lasted for about 6 months. It was stopped because of public health interventions. SARS had a very high case fatality rate, meaning that a very high proportion of patients who were infected died of SARS. It was really kind of very stringent and public health measures that were taken into place. So, for instance, to give you an example, with SARS in Singapore, Singapore was one of the first countries to actually eradicate SARS during the outbreak. They had to implement very stringent public health measures by essentially taking all patients with SARS and moving them, essentially quarantine them off in a single hospital, in other words, where they could get care, as well as quarantine off healthcare staff who are taking care of patients with SARS. So it really there were very strict measures that were needed in order to curb the SARS outbreak in different countries. And perhaps the same might be true from with this virus, where we might have to implement similar measures eventually.
I think to put things
Leslie McClurg.
I think to put things in context, and you can fact check me on this, but what I was reading yesterday was that, you know, the deaths right now from the current coronavirus is about 4% of the population who are infected, and it was something like 36% with SARS. So SARS was much more deadly, at least given the information we have now.
Well, let me go to Brianna in South San Francisco. Hi, Brianna. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go to Jeryl in South San Francisco. Hi, Jeryl. Are you there?
Hi. This is Brianna.
Hi, Brianna. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. So my question is the way the Chinese government calculate the number of deaths and number of infection is very different from how CDC in the United States calculate the number of infection and deaths, which uses an epidemiology model. Whereas in China, the number disclosed are confirmed by the laboratory test. And I'm wondering if by this method of calculation, the number we're receiving now is overly optimistic.
Hmm. Charles Chu?
The caller brings up an excellent point. It is true that there are different ways of defining kind of the number of fatalities, the number of deaths from the virus, and the number of cases. One number is what we call the microbiology confirmed number, which are basically cases that have been documented to be positive by laboratory testing. But she is also right in that we can project using mathematical modeling, we can project based based on the number of cases and the epidemiology that have been documented so far, we can project how many actual cases there actually are. One thing to recall is to remember is that these are really projections. So depending on whether or not you want to take a very conservative projection, which are the number of cases which have been laboratory confirmed, versus a more perhaps realistic or a more true projection, which are kind of predicted number of cases based on mathematical modeling. I mean, these are simply different numbers and different ways of sharing the data.
But are they dramatically different from each other? Do they tend to be?
They can be, especially early in an outbreak. You know, and it's certainly true that we are underestimating. By simply going by the numbers of actual laboratory confirmed cases, we definitely are underestimating the number of cases of the virus. But it's too soon right now to tell how big of a difference this really is.
Well, Anir Vaughn asks, how can the general public protect itself from others who have already been infected? Is the virus transmitted by air, by touch, or by some other means? I mean, you've mentioned, Charles Chu, that this is a highly contagious disease. So I mean, what are the best protections?
Great. So yes. So really, with coronaviruses in general, these are common cold viruses. And as far as we know from other coronaviruses, this is a virus that's spread by respiratory droplets. And so, really, common sense measures to prevent exposure to respiratory droplets from an infected patient or individual are recommended. So this would include stringent hand washing. This would include wearing a mask if you're having symptoms, or wearing a mask if you're in public places where you may be exposed to coughing or sneezing from somewhere nearby, as well as if you are developing respiratory symptoms and you've recently traveled to the affected region, Wuhan, China, for instance, a common sense measure would be simply not to show up for work or to school and to seek medical care as soon as possible, and let the medical facility as well, the clinic in which you're being seen, know that you've had recent travel to an affected area. So really, it's the same measures, public health measures, and the same individual measures that we would take to prevent influenza transmission, for instance, would also apply to this virus.
Well, Alice in Sunnyvale, what would you like to ask?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to know if you had any information or estimate from your experience what the incubation period might be from somebody who would have been infected until they might be able to not be contagious anymore.
Alice, thanks.
Great. So with respect to the incubation period, it's too early to tell specifically what the incubation period is for this virus. But if we go by other related viruses, say SARS coronavirus or MERS coronavirus, it's thought that the incubation period ranges from anywhere from 2 to 10 days, and at most probably 2 weeks. The median incubation period for these other coronaviruses was about 5 days, meaning that you would start to develop symptoms 5 days after you were exposed to the virus.
Well, Vicky asks, can you offer some advice to help us focus on safety, prevention, and not spreading the virus, what we can do? You touched on this earlier, Dr. Chu, but any final thoughts on the best methods of prevention other than the usual that we're probably used to in terms of washing your hands frequently and so on?
Yes, I really think with respect to the best methods of prevention, the other thing that can't be overstated is that really follow the public health guidance by the CDC, by your local state and public health agencies with respect to this virus. As we get information, as information starts to come in, it's really important that you monitor very closely kind of changes, new data that's coming in, and new recommendations if they're implemented. And really follow guidance by your public health agencies, because this is a global problem. It's very soon. It may not be a global public health emergency, but it's already a global problem given that it's affecting so many countries.
Yeah. So then, what are you watching for? I mean, when could this turn? I mean, it sounds like it could go in two different directions. One is it's mitigated, and the other is that it potentially explodes.
Yes, and right now we simply do not know kind of what the course of this virus is going to be.
Right, but what are you watching for as signals? When would you say to yourself, this is going?
We're watching for right now we're seeing an increase in number of cases on a daily basis. We're also seeing what we're watching for is – is basically where kind of a downtick. In other words, for several days, for instance, where we do not see additional cases, because that would suggest that at least that the rate of transmission has been limited or restricted or curbed. And it's really going to be where we see kind of the peak of cases arise, and then where we can see perhaps the influence of public health interventions in really stemming the outbreak.
So then in the meantime, Leslie McClurg, what can passengers coming from Wuhan expect to experience at SFO in their screening?
Well, they won't be arriving anymore because all of the flights coming out of Wuhan have been canceled. But there were, as of yesterday, still connecting flights. So people had traveled
right.
through Wuhan. So if they do arrive into the airport, they will have their temperature checked and they will have to fill out a health screen questionnaire asking if they've been coughing or fever, etc. And anyone who has traveled to China needs to just be on the alert. If you think you're maybe getting a tickle in your throat, head to the doctor. This is a time to be overly vigilant if you've been to China.
Leslie McClurg, KQED science reporter, and Dr. Charles Chu, professor of medicine at UCSF, specializing in infectious diseases. Thanks for joining us this morning and answering our questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.